Of the Senate Education, the House Education. Pleased to see everyone here so far. Let's see, we'll have everyone, others will be arriving shortly, but we have with us myself, Senator Stevens, Senate President Huggins, and Senator Dunleavy is here as well.
And on the House side, we have Representative Drummond, Representative Sadler, myself, Representative Gaddis, and Representative Seaton.
So thank you, yes. I'm sorry, Senator Gardner. That's fast. How'd you do that?
Has a, in the corner hiding.
Okay, thank you for being here. You know, today we're going to be hearing on the about the Alaska Performance Scholarship outcomes, getting that report, and we'll begin with Ms. Behrens, if you would mind coming up, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, for the record, my name is Diane Behrens. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education. And I'd like to thank both Chair Gaddis and Chair Stevens for the opportunity to present a briefing on the Alaska Performance Outcomes Report for 2013. This marks our second report to you. It represents just three semesters of data, but I think there are some interesting indicators that you'll hear about this morning. So with that, I would like to introduce Brian Ray, the report's author. Brian is our Assistant Director for Research and Policy Analysis at the Commission.
Thank you, Ms. Behrens. Mr. Ray, good to see you.
Good morning, and for the record, my name is Brian Ray, Assistant Director for Research and Policy Analysis at the Commission. I really appreciate this opportunity to review with you our work on the second annual Alaska Performance Outcomes Report. Well, when I say our work, I really do want to emphasize that this is a collaborative effort between the University of Alaska system and the Departments of Education and Early Development, and also the Department of Labor and Workforce Development, as well as the Commission, of course. I particularly want to thank my colleagues at the research agencies, at the partnering organizations, who have done a lot of work to pull this entire report together. This year's report is laid out similarly to last year's. I was initially worried that much of my presentation might seem like a repeat of last year's. However, see, there are several new members of your respective committees, so hopefully you'll find the presentation informative.
And excuse me, with that in mind, can the record reflect that Representative Ledoux has joined us? Thank you.
My plan is to present the findings of the report using the various topic areas that we have highlighted. Where do the APS eligible and the recipient graduates reside? Who is eligible and who is using it? Where do they pursue their post-secondary studies and so on? Addressing the first topic, where do APS eligible graduates reside? In this first slide, we summarize their residency based on their school district. The table's too large to fit onto one slide, so if you have the report in front of you, I suggest you can reference the tables on pages 8 and 9. As most of you are aware, we have federal regulations in place that protect student privacy. In particular, the Family Educational Rights and Privacy Act, or FERPA. That limits the information we can make public, so for the smaller school districts, some data must be suppressed. And while we can't publish eligibility data for these small population districts, I can say that in the scholarship's first 2 years, 48 of the 54 districts have graduated students who are eligible to receive the APS, and graduates from 42 of those districts have gone on to make use of the scholarship. In terms of magnitudes, there were really few surprises, with nearly 40% of the state's high school graduates. Anchorage School District has by far the largest number of both eligible and recipient students. Fairbanks is a fairly distant second in terms of their eligible graduates, followed by Matsu and Kenai.
So you're saying we don't know the percentages because that would give away who got the scholarships?
Through the chair, that is correct under the guidelines imposed by the Family Educational Rights and Privacy Act. Educational attainment and levels of educational performance are not reportable for small districts.
Is that one of our laws or one of the Fed's laws?
Through the chair, it's one of the federal regulations.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Du. Senator Stedman is with us. Please continue. Senator Gardner.
Thank you. I have a question. You say 48 of the districts have had eligible graduates. Is that correct?
That is correct.
I just kind of went through and counted on this year 12, AY, academic year 12. And 27 of the districts are listed as having no eligible graduates.
Through the chair, the asterisk does not mean that there is none.
Oh, good.
The asterisk means that we cannot report
okay.
the
All
data.
All right, that's
the
what
data,
you're talking about.
The data has to be suppressed, and otherwise someone might be able to ascertain the identity of a student in that district.
Thank you. So I have one other quick question. Is that so Chugach School District, which boasts quite rightly of a 98% graduation rate, we can assume that some of their students qualified, but you couldn't list them because there are only 13 students graduating last year?
Through the chair, that would be correct, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I think last year we talked about trying to have some of these remote schools combined to put some validity in the report. Some of us that represent a lot of these communities become worthless information when it's not reported to us. And I was wondering what the status of having these smaller communities in regions, and if you want to do Western Alaska, Southeast, or some combination, so we can get an idea of where our smaller schools are.
Thank you, Senator Stedman. Yes.
Through the chair, we do later in the report include, as we did last year, a breakout by regions of the state. There's also the ability, and I do believe we were able to provide last year, some information on the smaller school districts. We aggregated that information and show you aggregated numbers for these small population districts.
Thank you. Representative Drummond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You said that Fairbanks was a distant second to Anchorage in terms of number of graduates. I'm assuming that the number of graduates and the eligible graduates is in proportion to the size of the school district, the population of each school district?
Through the chair, actually, Fairbanks is second in terms of the number of eligible graduates. I believe that they're third in terms of the total population of total students that they graduated. So it is not always the case that there will be proportionality between the number of graduates and the number of eligible graduates. In statewide, we've seen it's 27.2% of graduates do achieve APS eligibility, but that does vary by the districts.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Stedman?
I'm sorry.
Yeah. Okay, Charlie. Yeah, Charlie Huggins. It appears that Haynes is twice as eligible as just about everybody else at 65%. Were they got the world's smartest and best teachers or what? I mean, we ought to go down and figure that one out. What do you reckon?
Through the chair, there's oftentimes, and we've just noticed this in these 2 years, but there are oftentimes school districts that have, particularly smaller ones, that will have wide ranges of students, percentages who achieve APS eligibility. It, to some degree, that's statistical noise that you can see, in particularly in these very small districts. I can't speak why this Haynes district might have a higher rate this year, and certainly can't speak on why those students were eligible and what might have made them eligible.
Yeah. But I do think it's worth us looking at. They're twice the percentile eligible of most of the school district. It's three times Massou's. Anyway, thank you.
Thank you, Senator Huggins. Representative Du.
At what point, how many kids does a school district have before you're able to report? I mean, like I say that Gateway School District, it has 13 graduates. I mean, why if you reported one or two people, why would that give away who it was?
Through the chair, the statistical, what's called suppression rules, that is suggested by FERPA, by the U.S. Department of Education, is that we have to maintain a cell size that would not allow a student to be easily identified by a person who is local, who has local knowledge. And what we have determined that to be was five students. So we will report any number that is five or greater. If the number is less than five for eligible students, then we wouldn't publish it. We do publish smaller number for APS recipients, so long as the district had eligible graduates that were at 5 or greater. The reason is that receipt of the APS does not necessarily violate any of the FERPA regulations, but identifying a student who may have performed either well or not well in a district does violate those regulations.
Please, Representative.
So let's just start with the top, Alaska Gateway. Okay, it's got 13 students, but I'm not necessarily supposed to assume that there were no eligible?
Through the chair, that is correct. There could be anywhere from none to 4 students eligible at Alaska Gateway.
How would that give it away? I mean, I don't get it. Especially since everybody in the community knows about it anyway.
Through the chair, we rely on the regulations as created through the U.S. Department of Education, and we have to abide by those for privacy rights.
Thank you.
So the suppression rules are 5. That's the number you deal with.
To the chair, that is correct.
Further questions?
Can we let the record show that Representative Reinbold has joined us?
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman. I have a question from Senator Stedman.
Just back on that earlier question about consolidation, I thought maybe I wasn't looking at the report as close as I should have and missed it, but I went back through it. I don't see any consolidation on the village schools in Southeast at all. I see a consolidation of Southeast Alaska. But you can't put Ketchikan, Juneau, Sitka, Wrangell, that stand out nation or statewide on their academic scores against the schools of Kaycan, Metlakatla, Heidelberg. So the regional analysis page number 4, you know, has got some, you know, I guess some validity to it, but it's not the detail that I need to know how my schools are doing in a program that we've been very concerned about since the beginning, that the smaller schools are going to be disprivileged in the process. So I would like to see if we can't have, Mr. Chairman, consolidation of the village schools or smaller schools, and that mixed up, and if we can't, then find out why. The second question I have, Mr. Chairman, is Mount Edgecombe High School, eligible recipients 18%. Mount Edgecombe High School is probably the top high school in the state. So it just seems odd that Mount Edgecombe would score so low. I would expect them to be an outlier and outpointing Haynes. And final thing, Mr. Chairman, I won't get into discussion with my colleague, Senator Huggins, of why the kids in Southeast outscore Mat-Su, which just getting ready for basketball games and other things that we have to do with Mat-Su on.
It all comes back to basketball. Yes. Well, thank you. So a couple of questions there. One on consolidation, the other one on Mount Edgecombe.
Yes, for the record, Diane Behrens, through the chair, Senator Stedman, we certainly can respond to legislators who would like to have certain schools or within their districts rolled up. The purpose of the outcomes report is just to present information that is broadly of interest to the public, to the legislature, but certainly we can roll that up, and if the numbers are sufficiently large to share, to disclose, then we would be able to do that. If they were not sufficiently large to disclose, then that would be an indicator of its own kind.
Right, thank you very much. Senator Stedman, are you satisfied with that? You can...
Yes, Mr. Chairman, they can get back to me on that roll-up number, but one of the fundamental arguments or discussion points that we've had since the introduction of this program is the disadvantage that rural schools face against the urban schools, and by not laying it out so the public can see, I think it's not good public policy. But I do appreciate the information delivered back to you.
And through the chair, Senator Stedman, with respect to your question regarding Mount Edgecombe, this is simply presenting the data as we received it. So if you were interested in having a discussion with the leadership at Mount Edgecombe about the percentage of their students that are qualifying, you know, that is, in essence, part of the point of having this light shed on the data, is so that it could spark those kinds of discussions and discovery.
Certainly. Other questions? Thank you, Mr. Rang.
Very good. And as I pointed out, we do have quite a number or a very small number of school districts which dominate the percentage of graduates for districts with 70%. But we also had 11 of the state's districts that had fewer than 10 graduates. And that was part of the reason why we see such an amount of suppression in the data. Statewide, there was 27.2% of last year's public high school graduates were eligible for the APS, and that's down slightly from 29% in the previous year. While some of the decline could be attributed to normal year-to-year fluctuations, there was an increase in the curriculum requirements necessary to become eligible for the APS. The rigorous curriculum requirements are being phased in through 2015. In order to allow students time to adjust their course-taking patterns to become eligible for the APS. But again, there was some very large differences between the districts and the percent eligibility. If you included the suppressed districts, 9 of the districts had eligibility rates that were above 35%, and 6 of those districts had eligibility rates that were above 40%. In our next slide, this is Exhibit 2 in the report. Presents the data from the first exhibit by regions of the state, which we just mentioned earlier. This pattern of ACS eligibility and usage is fairly similar to last year's, and I still find this chart to be one of the more interesting ones in the report. Because there are such large differences in the numbers of graduates coming from the various districts, it's easier to make cross-region comparisons using percentages. In Exhibit 2, we see that the interior region had the highest percentage of graduates who were academically eligible to receive an APS award at 30.4%. And the far north region had the lowest at 11.2%. Still, school districts within these regions did differ. For example, Nome in the far north region had an eligibility rate that was 6 percentage points above the statewide average. However, when we consider the percentages of those students who were eligible for the award and then actually went on to make use of it, we find that both the far north and the interior regions, two opposite ends of the extreme on eligibility, were the regions that had the highest usage rate for the awards. Approximately one half of the eligible students from these two regions did take advantage of the APS. The next slide.
Sure, we have a question from Senator Dunleavy.
Thank you, through the chair. Just a quick question. Is there any validity to the statement or rumor that middle school classes or courses in smaller schools are being used in this formula to determine eligibility? Are there any instances where there's middle school classes that are being applied or used?
Through the chair, I am not aware of that being the case, but I will defer that question to Commissioner Horst.
I can respond to that through the chair, Senator Dunleavy. Not in the first two cohorts. Last year, legislation was passed that allowed the Department of Education through regulation to promulgate rules around which a high school level course taken in middle school could be transcripted as part of the satisfying the APS curriculum. That will be applicable for the first time for the graduates in 2013.
So it's not, excuse me.
Yeah, please.
Just very quickly through the chair. So it's not a middle school course. It's a high school course that's taken by a middle school student.
Exactly.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Resident Adu.
So I want to make sure I understand this. Is everybody operating on the same plane? In other words, is this simply the curriculum of the school and the grades in the school, or is this a standardized test that measures, a person's performance if they are in Anchorage versus a person's performance if they are in Nome or someplace else?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, the requirements to qualify actually have 3 components. The student must have completed certain curricular requirements, and that's set out. The department, through regulation, has identified what those requirements are. They are being phased in between 2011 and 2015 to a full complement of requirements. But the other two components are a grade point average that the person must achieve in high school, and there are certain scores on either the SAT, ACT, or work keys assessment that they must achieve at a minimum. So if one of those three components is missing, they do not qualify.
So in other words, if the bell curve in Region A is different and on a lower level than the bell curve in Region B, then somebody could qualify for the performance scholarship in region, in one of those regions that wouldn't qualify in the other region. Am I correct on that?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, I understand the point you're making. The reason I believe the legislature included the minimum cut scores is that's a those are nationally normed tests. So the students have to achieve certain levels of proficiency regardless of what the bell curve was in a particular class, course, or school.
But that's just one of the components. That's so that still, if you met that minimum level, but you were operating in a school district which was easier than another school district that might be harder, you might make the cut for the performance scholarship where somebody in the harder school district where their grades were lower wouldn't make it. Am I correct on that?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, if the student did not perform and get the grades necessary, the minimum level is a 2.5. So if they scored below a 2.5 GPA, then that is correct. They would not qualify for the scholarship.
If I may, through the chair, there is not a single cut score as to whether you're eligible for the APS or not eligible for it in terms of your SAT and ACT scores. There are three different scores that you can achieve, and it determines whether you're a level 3 eligibility, 2, or receiving the top eligibility. So they are using standardized testing to determine the level that the student would be able to receive an award through the APS.
I just want to make it clear, but that's just for one component, right? And grades are the other component?
Through the chair, the score that, excuse me, the award level that a student will receive is based on the lowest eligibility achievement that they have. So if they score a very high standardized test score, but they have a 2.6 GPA, they will only get the level 3 award. So their GPA in that case could hold them down, even though they have shown that they have met a higher level for their standardized testing.
So in other words, I just want to really clarify this. If the school districts aren't operating on the same plane, we're in at least for the grades, we're comparing apples to oranges.
Through the chair, I would say that the possibility, there is no possibility that a school district who would give everyone a 4.0 would see all of their students becoming eligible at the highest level because the standardized test scores would pull students down. I can see a possibility where a school that had a very high criteria for meeting, you know, their GPA requirements could hold a student down.
Thank you.
Thank you. We're going to do Ms. Behrens.
Yes, just to add to that discussion a bit, through the chair, Representative Ledoux, we don't currently receive the underlying elements. So we don't receive a GPA. We don't receive a cut score. The districts actually indicate by a flag which level of award that the student qualifies for. In the event that we have that data in future years, which is something under discussion, we would be able to do some analysis around whether or not it appeared students were, perhaps if the GPA were the level setting component, that they might get a higher award, but because of the test score, they're actually getting a lower award or vice versa. So right now, we simply don't have the data to really inform the discussion around this issue.
Thank you.
Quick question that kind of piggybacks on this. So do all the school districts offer all the classes necessary to get this scholarship? And if they don't, are they eligible to use correspondence or online courses to get to that point?
Madam Chair, Commissioner Hanley is here for questions. And so I don't know if you want to bring him up or proceed through the report and then have those types of questions handled at the end.
Okay, if you would hold that, Representative Gattis, we'll get to Commissioner shortly, if you don't mind. Yes, Representative Grant.
Okay, we're going to go back a slide. It's to the, you know, where it was the southeast. Okay, that one. On the left-hand column, the southeast, 11% of graduates. How does that compare with the 27 and the 29? I understand the blue and the gold. The blue is the number of eligible graduates, and the gold is the ones accepting, but the 11% of the graduates. Can you just explain that on the left-hand column?
Yes, certainly, through the chair to Representative Reinbold. That is just an attempt to show the magnitude, the scale of the different regions. So if we look at South Central, as I said, you know, four school districts, which included Anchorage, Matsu, and Kenai, three are included in South Central, have 70% of the graduates in the state. You'll see that South Central accounted for 61.4% of all of the state's graduates.
So simply adding all of those numbers up on the left, you'd wind up with 100%.
Hopefully. Through the chair.
Through the chair, hopefully. We won't explore that any further. Thank you very much. I guess that's all the questions. Please continue, Mr. Ray.
Very good. This slide's data refers to the report's second topic area, which was the characteristics of the APS eligible and recipient students. As shown here in Exhibit 3, when we reviewed the graduates' eligibility data by their ethnicity, again this year we saw fairly large differences in eligibility rates. Remembering that on average 27.2% of graduates were eligible, 35% of Caucasian graduates ended up becoming eligible, at least academically eligible, compared to 10.5% of Alaska Native and American Indian graduates. Still, though, once a student becomes APS eligible, the usage rates are much more similar across the various ethnic groups, with just over 1 in 3 eligible graduates taking advantage of the scholarship the fall following their high school graduation. When reviewing eligibility and usage by gender, again this year we found that female graduates are somewhat more likely to be eligible to receive the APS than are male graduates. However, again, these gender differences seem to disappear when we consider the likelihood that a student is going to go ahead and take advantage and use the APS the fall following their graduation. Again, just over 1/3 of both sexes did so last year.
Yes, Representative Drummond, I knew someone would rise to the bait there.
Actually, I was looking at the number of graduates that were eligible in the Alaska Native American Indian category, and thinking back to our presentation on ANSEP the other day, it would be really interesting to look at the percentage that were eligible of ANSEP tracked students and see how that compares to the Alaska Native American Indian track overall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Any response?
Through the chair, as a researcher, I would love to be able to do that.
Well, I think I would bet that the numbers are available, but it would be hard because of the small numbers of students coming from
and just the ability to share that data and match it.
I'm sure Professor Schroeder would be happy to share the data.
Thank you, Representative Duke.
So, can people use these performance scholarships in out-of-state schools also?
I'm sorry, I missed.
In out-of-state schools also. Can they use it, you know, in Oregon?
No, the eligibility or the requirements to receive the scholarship require you to attend in-state school.
Yes, Representative Liddell.
So maybe some of these differences between eligibility and people actually using them are accounted for by people going out of state.
Through the chair, that's absolutely correct.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Through the chair, just a quick question. Besides the University of Alaska, what other in-state colleges can students attend? with the scholarship or apply the scholarship?
Through the chair, and Diane is looking up exactly the same information, but there is an appendix in the report that provides a list of all of the schools that students can attend and still receive the APS.
So they, excuse me.
Yes, through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, there's a quite an extensive list in the report that kind of precludes.
APU is on that list?
Yes.
Wayland Baptist is on that list?
That is correct.
These are private schools, correct?
That is correct.
And some of them could be sectarian in nature as well?
Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, that's correct.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Dunleavy. Register to do.
My understanding is that one of the reasons why we're discussing in the legislature this year a constitutional amendment dealing with vouchers or scholarships or whatever you want to call it is that public, my understanding is that public money doesn't, is not supposed to constitutionally go into religious or private education. So I guess I don't understand what the difference is between high school and this program, why this is constitutionally acceptable and the other is not constitutionally acceptable.
That's an interesting point. I'm sure we'll get deep into that as the session goes on, but any response?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, certainly I'm not a constitutional attorney or attorney of any stripe. However, the history in the state of student financial aid is that students can take their financial aid to the school that they choose, and so long as that school is either authorized or accredited, they can attend there with that support. It has not been challenged in court, so the question of constitutionality is really not resolved.
Thank you, Mr. Burns.
Thank you.
Any comments? Mr. Ray.
In Exhibit 4, we make our first true year-to-year comparison. We see that here we have spent an increase in the usage of the APS by those APS-eligible students, and this has really been driven by those students at both the top and the bottom award levels. At the top award level, usage increased a percentage point from 28.4 to 29.4% of those eligible students actually going on to make use of it. At level 3, the usage increased by over 10 percentage points. This could be normal year-to-year swings, and there was a 4.5 percentage point drop in level 2 eligible students making use of the award. And we can't say with certainty why these shifts in usage are occurred. However, there was definitely increased awareness and a longer window of opportunity for AY12 graduates to plan on using the APS than there was for the AY11 graduates. We believe this could have been a factor in the APS usage, particularly at certain groups, and it's probably worthwhile to bring up the next slide with some survey findings at this time.
Before you go on that, the count is only one student difference in the level two. I mean, that's pretty remarkable. What we're really comparing it to, I suppose, is the total eligible. That's the big number.
That is exactly correct, that we have seen an increased eligibility for level two recipients.
Thank you.
If you're following in the report, we're jumping to Exhibits 20 and 21 on page 34. For each of the two graduating class years, we conducted a survey of APS-eligible students during the summer following their graduation, and we asked them how much they knew about the APS and how the possibility of receiving the APS affected their high school experience and their decisions on post-secondary attendance. While not included in this table, for the first year's graduates, only 55% reported being aware of their APS eligibility either before or near the beginning of their final or their last semester in high school. And even for these students who were aware of the APS, that's a very late date to have the scholarship have any effect on their plans or their post-secondary attendance decisions. By then, many of the top performing students would have already accepted offers from post-secondary institutions, and those students who were not planning to attend may have felt it too late to have changed those plans. There were even fewer opportunities for students to affect their eligibility to receive the APS award by taking different classes or taking or retaking standardized test score or testing. For the most recent graduating class, 70% said they knew about their APS eligibility prior to their final semester, and upon graduation, APS students knew more about the details of their awards. 85% knew the award level that they were going to be receiving. That was compared to only 68% in the previous year. And they were much more likely to know the actual amount of the award that they would be receiving. AY12 graduates also had time to change their behaviors in order to become eligible for the award or for higher levels of it. Only one half of the AY12 graduates said they made changes to their plans while in high school, and that's compared to two-thirds of the AY11 surveyed graduates said they had changed their plans. The most likely choices they made were they chose different classes in order to meet the rigorous curricular requirements for the APS, but there are also increases in the amount of effort they put forth to boost their GPA, and nearly 20% said that they either took or retook tests to achieve higher scores. The exhibits on the next two slides I'm about to show you use data obtained from the National Student Clearinghouse, which is a repository of data on students attending post-secondary institutions throughout the U.S. Of the 7,985 public high school graduates in 2012, 29% were shown to be attending in-state, and 17% attended to an out-of-state post-secondary institution the fall following their graduation. However, there's a notable difference in the attendance rates of the APS-eligible populations versus those ineligible populations. 81% of APS-eligible students pursued post-secondary education somewhere, whether in Alaska or outside of the state, the fall following their graduation, while only 31% of the ineligible students did so. There are also noticeable differences in the attendance patterns of the APS-eligible population based on their award level. While there's a large economic incentive for those students at the highest award level to actually make use of it by attending in-state, since the top award amount is twice that of the lowest award amount, the APS-eligible students at the top award level were the ones that were most likely to attend an out-of-state institution, while those at the second and third levels of the award were more likely to attend in-state. Moving on to the second slide I'd mentioned, we see that the differences in attendance patterns of the APS-eligible population based on their award level was also evident last year, but there have been some differences emerging. In both years, looking at the level one, the two bars on the left-hand side of the table, in both years, nearly 90% of students eligible for the top award level pursued post-secondary education somewhere the fall following their high school graduation. That compares about 75% of those in the level three category. Note, however, that as we pointed out earlier in Exhibit 5, the percentages of students at the top and the bottom award levels showed increasing enrollments in-state and declining enrollments outside of Alaska. And although we cannot say with certainty the increased awareness of the APS again for the class of 2012 may have influenced those students' decisions to attend an in-state institution. For those interested, the National Student Clearinghouse does identify the states where the students attended. Probably not surprisingly, Washington and Oregon were the two states where most of the class of AY12 who attended an out-of-state school decided to attend. That's in Appendix D on page 45 of the report.
Thank you, Representative Sandler. Any questions?
Thank you, sir. Briefly, I don't know if you have the funding or manpower or inclination, but do you plan to track the post-secondary completion rates? Actually, how well they're going to graduate?
Through the chair, we certainly do plan on tracking post-secondary completion rates, and also, to the best of our ability, tracking the migrations of students in and out of the state in post-secondary education.
Thank you.
Moving on to the next slide, Exhibit 7, we analyzed use of the students' use of their APS by their expected family contribution. This is the amount that goes towards their post-secondary education, and it's important to note that financial need is not a factor in determining eligibility for the APS. In this case, we're using the expected family contribution, it's also known as the EFC, to serve as a proxy for a student's income status. For both years, we broke APS recipients out into four EFC quartiles. Students in the lowest quartile were expected to contribute less than roughly $6,000 per year to their education, and those in the highest were above about $33,000 per year. We don't want to read too much into the numbers. However, it's somewhat intriguing that students eligible for the top award level, which are those students in the darker gold at the top, and the higher income quartiles, so to the right side of the graph, those students were the ones that seemed most likely to use their scholarship in AY12 compared to AY11. This goes back to the earlier discussion where we're seeing more of the top tier students who are coming in and continuing to use, or using it in their second year of the program. If lack of awareness
from Mr. Sadler on that
over here, sir. This is a good information. It's a busy chart. I wonder if you could give me like a read to me a sentence or two.
Just again. I think it would help us a little bit.
Yeah, it just a lot going on there.
Through the chair to all. Certainly. In AY11, the first year of the program, those bars are on the left-hand side of each of the four pairings that you see. 59 APS Level 1 graduates actually made use of the APS the fall following their graduation, 90 at level 2 and 69 at level 3. If we carry that forward to the highest quartile, those students who were expected to contribute roughly $33,000 or more per year.
I'm sorry, that's numbers, 59, 90, 69 is numbers?
Yes, the numbers of students. Numbers. Okay. That's correct.
So just, the 93%, maybe just help us understand that. That is... The level one, and it's contributing $33,000.
The lowest, the highest quartile, the two bars on your right, represent students who were expected to contribute either directly but through themselves or by their family $33,000 or more to attend school that year.
And Mr. Chair, that's a head count number, not a percent.
Yes.
Right.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Lejeune.
Am I missing something here? I don't see where it says 33,000. I don't see where we're getting any of the income numbers on this chart.
Through the chair, those numbers are included in the report itself, but they are not part of this chart.
Included in the what?
In the report itself.
Thank you.
In the narrative of the report.
But that's the basis for the chart, is that 33,000.
Those with an income above 33,000 are included in the two bars on the right-hand side, having the highest expected family contribution.
Right, just for my edification. So basically, the higher to the right, highest quartile is the wealthiest families can provide the most expected family contribution. Lowest quartile, poorer or richer.
Through the chair, that's correct.
Yes. Okay. And what's the conclusion we should draw from this chart?
What we had noticed was that we were seeing more students eligibility level one attending than we saw last year. You saw that last year there was 79 students who were in the highest quartile of income. 79 now has become 93 students who are taking advantage of the APS this year. If we go down to the third quartile, these families were still expected to contribute a significant amount of towards the child's education. We're seeing 77 moving to 91. These are the groups where we're seeing the largest gains from year to year. If we look at a continuum of expected family contributions, potentially ability to pay for school, and the award levels. So higher award levels oftentimes do seem to be attracted or be competed for by out-of-state schools. More institutions are looking to have them attend their institution.
So, and just to nip it off, I guess, thank you, sir. So basically more of these students who are eligible for and receiving the top level of the award are using it and are attending, presumably in Alaska, is that the?
Through the chair to receive it, you would have to attend in Alaska, yes.
So the program is working well to attract kids to attend school and attend school in Alaska.
Through the chair, as a researcher, I will not jump to a conclusion, but the underlying evidence does seem to suggest.
Okay, let us jump to those conclusions. Thank you very much. Please continue.
On this next slide, we move to the topic of where the APS recipients were pursuing their post-secondary education. Overwhelmingly, it was at one of the University of Alaska system schools. which accounted for 99% of the total recipients from the graduating class of 2012. That's the first column of numbers you see there. And the same percentage of total recipients in the fall of 2012. The second column of numbers represents those students who graduated in AY11, were eligible for the APS, and were now receiving the APS in fall of 2012 at the University of Alaska. Numbers have increased slightly since this table was created, in an increase in all of the schools in this chart.
So the other institutions we had talked about outside the university are fairly small in numbers. 9 students and 12 and only 6 and 11.
That is correct. Again, 99% of the eligibility of the eligible students who are now receiving it are attending one of the UA system schools.
Right. Thank you.
Leads us to the next topic, an area that we addressed in the report, is how much in APS funds was awarded and for what types of enrollment. Exhibit 9 clearly shows overwhelmingly APS recipients are enrolling in bachelor's degree programs. Nearly 88% of all recipients did so. Also, as displayed in this next slide, Exhibit 10, they're overwhelmingly enrolled on a full-time basis. Aside from a student's eligibility level, the only other factor that affects the amount of the award received is the student's enrollment status. Part-time students, those students who are completing fewer than 24 but at least 12 credit hours in a year, and fewer than 30 but at least 15 credit hours with the start of their sophomore, junior, and senior years, they see a 50% reduction in their maximum scholarship amount by going half-time versus going full-time.
Thank you. Representative Sadler.
And sir, the y-axis is dollars, or?
Apologies for leaving off the assign. Yes, the y-axis is dollars.
So that's the amount of benefit received and applied.
Right. Full-time recipients, given both years of the APS program this current year, $5,300,000.
Thank you.
Also, though, going back to the part-time, full-time discussion, the use of the scholarship in any semester counts against the student's totals of 8 semesters of eligibility. So there's a very strong incentive for the students to make sure that they are attending full-time so that they don't lose the eligibility, maximize the amount of the APS award they'll receive. The next topic areas we'll address are how the APS affects educational attainment and how it affects workforce success. And unfortunately, it's still far too early to reach any conclusions based on the information that we currently have available to us. Currently, remember that there's only preliminary information on students' educational attainment, and there's none on students' future workforce success. Though we did present some baseline information, wage data information this year, for comparison purposes in future years. So continuing to the next slide, considering educational attainment, we still have only one semester of post-secondary education data available for the class of AY12. We do now have 3 semesters for the first year's APS recipients, and we'll look more closely into the class of AY11 here in just a few minutes. We know that the pursuit of additional education after high school has obvious benefits, but research studies show that students who pursue their post-secondary education soon after graduation from high school actually enjoy several advantages over those who delay. Retention of information learned in high school diminishes over time, so attending sooner reduces the requirement or the need for remedial classes. Also, students who attend immediately following graduation are more likely to complete their degree or certificate than are those who delay their post-secondary enrollment.
So I understand that this is just simply too early to really draw conclusions, but as a statistician, how many years do you really need before you can begin to figure out the impact, whether it's really affecting folks or not?
Well, as a question arose earlier, actually looking at completion, for example, looking at time to completion to see whether a student completed their degree in 4 years, what used to be the norm of a 4-year completion now seems to have drawn into a 5- and a 6-year time frame. So for the educational attainment, we would use that as a factor to determine whether we thought the APS had positively affected or APS recipients had different outcomes than the non-recipients. So we're looking at the earliest 4 years after the first year's graduating class. Oftentimes we may have to extend that to 5 and 6 years to compare to their peers who did eventually graduate in 6 years. They did attain a degree, but did they, the APS eligible recipients, obtain it sooner at less cost, hopefully.
Thank you. Senator Gardner?
Thank you. Does that shift from 4 years to 5 or 6, is that nationwide? And do we know why that's happened? Is it economic? Is it the inability of students to get the sequential classes they need when they need them? I mean, do we know what factors are causing that?
Through the chair, and I'm going to also defer to Diane as well, it does appear to be nationwide. Many of the metrics that have been used before are now considering graduation rates within 6 years to be a benchmark, a reporting mark, to say this is when we want to give you how many of our students actually graduated through a post-secondary program.
And the lack of jobs in the market possibly could impact that. Ms. Behrens, comments?
Yes. Through the chair, Senator Gardner, it is nationwide, although if you parse out school types or sectors, you'll see real distinct differences in the rate at which students complete on time. Highly selective schools typically will have on-time completion rates, and their definition of on-time is typically 4 years, four-year program in 4 years. That exceeds 80%, whereas if you look at community colleges where you will have individuals attending who are less academically prepared may have numbers that are, you know, south of 30% mm-hmm. for on-time completion, and that's defined as 150% of the normal time to complete the degree. So I believe that as you see increasing numbers of students pursuing post-secondary education, and there's a broader population, mm-hmm. more diverse population included in that pool, it would not be unexpected to see those students taking longer, either because they don't have the academic preparation or, you know, they're unwilling to incur the kind of debt that it may take to go full time. So there are lots of factors that are involved.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, sir. Chart Exhibits 13 indicates, well, actually, let me preface that. I remember this, the Alaska Performa Scholarship Program was amended to expand it beyond academic to also include vocational education. So Exhibit 13 includes data that shows that those seeking vocational certificates or associate degrees and who earn the APS are lower numbers than those who were going to seek them anyway. Again, I'm not a statistician. Any conclusions we could draw or should draw about expanding this program from purely academic to also include vocational, given these numbers? For example, certificate seekers, I'm seeing 1.6% of the APS recipients sought certificates versus 3% of all. And in AY12, we have 1.9% versus 2.7% for the larger universe.
Through the chair, I'm you're calculating the numbers of 14 to 75 and 14 to 56. Is that what I'm?
See again.
You're calculating the percentages based on 14 of 75 and 14 of 56. Is that what I'm understanding when you come in with your percentage?
I don't understand your reference. I'm looking at the bottom row, the far right four columns.
Percentages. Oh, the 1.6, 2.7, 1.9. So, excuse me.
You might point that out so they all are on the same. What line are you on?
The bottom row, certificate seekers, and the final four columns,
right.
3% versus 1.6% of the APS recipients, and 2.7 versus 1.9. The conclusion I seem to be drawing, and I want to correct me if I'm wrong, is that those who got the APS scholarship and applied them to certificates or associate degrees, it's a lower number. Is there an inference that it's not necessary, not of utility?
Through the chair, I think what you're saying is what I was going to say in reverse, which was we look at the 80, it's going to add to 100. We're looking at the APS recipients are predominantly in AY11, 84.1% of them pursued a bachelor's degree. So that left, obviously, only 16% to pursue something other than a bachelor's degree. So fewer of them were using them to obtain a certificate, 1.6%. 14.3% were using them to obtain an associate's degree. So it's, right, you're saying exactly what the chart is intending to say.
Could you restate that more elegantly than I did?
Well, what I would say is that for those students who attended the University of Alaska in AY11 and were APS eligible, for that reason they also then became an APS recipient, those students were more likely than the entire class who attended UA in that year to pursue a bachelor's degree.
And less likely to seek
and less likely to have pursued a certificate or an associate's degree.
Thank you.
So that finished up my comments on that slide. Thank you. But we can't. What we will say, just to recap, is for the APS recipients, we're seeing of the total population for, let's again looking at AY11, 8,062 high school graduates in that year. For all of them combined, 31.2% decided to attend the University of Alaska, pursue their post-secondary education there the fall following their graduation. But if you were an APS-eligible student, a population of 2339 students, 37.5% of them decided to attend the university the fall following their graduation. So, again, if we consider that research has shown, studies have shown that you're more likely to finish your degree if you start early, you're less likely to require remediation if you start early. If we're incentivizing these students to attend earlier, start their post-secondary careers earlier, then that is likely to be a benefit in the long run to make sure that we have higher completion rates in a shorter period of time with less remediation.
Right. Thank you.
The next slide is Exhibit 12. I jumped in the report a bit, but this contains information on those students' need for preparatory courses when they first enter post-secondary ed. Note that these students could be graduates from any year. This is data from the University of Alaska. They're included in the analysis if their first time attending a post-secondary institution was at the University of Alaska in the fall of 2012. So these aren't necessarily just the prior year's graduates. There were a total of 3,284 first-time freshmen attended UA in that semester, and of these, 892 received APS awards. An analysis of the course-taking patterns of the APS-eligible population compared to the non-APS population showed some interesting differences. For example, ineligible students were nearly three times as likely to take a preparatory class than were APS recipients. It's 65.2% versus 22.6%.
I'm sorry, this is a lot of material, and it would have been easier if you had a pointer so we could follow you. So tell me where you are right now.
I may. If we're looking at the non-APS recipient population, of the 2,380 students who entered UA for the first time that fall semester, 1,551 of them enrolled in a remedial class, or 65% of them. If we look at the APS recipient population, we see that only 22.6% of those students enrolled in a remedial class.
Right.
In terms of the average preparatory hours taken, those students who enrolled and were not APS eligible were taking 2.8 hours. And the APS-eligible students were taking 0.8 hours. Preparatory hours do not count towards your degree. So we also then look at the number of average total hours attempted. It was 11.3 for the non-APS-eligible students. It was 14 hours for the APS-eligible students. So at the end of the day, if, again, these were preliminary numbers, this is the anticipated classes that the student was hoping that they were going to take and finish and pass. So it is still, you know, preliminary numbers, but the average APS eligible student would have earned 13.2 credit hours applicable to a degree at the end of the fall semester, while the average ineligible student would have earned only 8.5 hours. So the APS students are showing they have a significant jump towards the completion of their degree after the first semester.
Thank you. Representative Duke.
Is this supposed to show us the effectiveness of the APS program, or simply that the people who get APS scholarships might be smarter or more prepared regardless of whether they'd gotten the scholarships? I guess I don't understand what it means.
Through the chair, I don't think that there's any intention to take a factor out of the equation. Obviously, the higher level APS students have shown through their standardized test scores, through their GPAs, through their taking a rigorous curricula, that they have accomplished a level of competency that would indicate that they probably are going to perform better when they go to college. So we're not saying that that's not the case in these numbers. What we are saying is that it's kind of being shown in the numbers after their first semester of attendance that if you're incentivizing them to attend early, therefore there's generally less remediation because there's less forgotten knowledge laid aside during a layover period. If we're incentivizing them to attend early, then we will see less remediation. Studies have shown that if they attend early, they're more likely to complete their degree. It all works together.
Through the chair, do we have any idea whether or not the reason why they're attending early is because of the APS scholarship?
Through the chair, was showing you the comparisons between the AY11 and the AY12 classes, and while there was a similar levels of post-secondary attendance, whether it was in-state or out-of-state for most of the award level eligible students, we are now seeing that more of them are attending are attending school in-state. So at least to that degree, we are seeing, again, some aspect of the APS may be coming into play. Last year, many of the students had either already made plans or were not aware of their APS eligibility and how it could benefit them.
And if I just could add on that point to the chair, Representative Ledoux, you know, it's really going to be only over time when we have longitudinal data that show trends and patterns that you're going to see truly what the impact of the Alaska Performance Scholarship is. Ideally, we would see more students ultimately qualifying. One of the things that we would like to have over time is a data set that has information about not only the students who are APS eligible, but the students who are not APS eligible. I mean, ideally, if students are striving for the APS, whether or not they actually qualify for it or not, they will ultimately be better prepared if they go on to post-secondary education. So we really have to have much more data in order to really try to reach any conclusions about the impact of the program.
Right. Senator Gardner, and then we'll come back to
you. Thank you. My question was answered.
Oh, thank you. Representative
Sadler. Thank you. Real briefly, I do understand this slide clearly, and I think it shows laudably that the Performance Scholarship Program is having its intended effect, requiring students to take more rigorous curriculum in high school, avoiding the need for remediation, and improving outcomes in post-secondary. So, good on you.
Very, very good information. Thank you.
I mentioned earlier, and let's change our focus back to the AY11 graduates. The first year that was eligible to receive the APS. We're doing that because we now have three semesters of data on these students. Though the fall 2012 data still is preliminary data in these exhibits. These next two slides, this exhibit 14 and 15, which I'll show you in a moment, show if the students pursued post-secondary education after they graduated, and if so, did they attend in-state or attend out-of-state. This information, again, comes from the National Student Clearinghouse database. If we're looking at first at APS eligible graduates, of which there were 2,339 in the class of AY11, 41.8% of them attended in-state the fall following their high school graduation. That's 977 students. And this is represented again by this leftmost bar here. We're looking at those who actually attended in Alaska. The following spring, some of these students, 0.3% of the total APS population, were found attending an out-of-state school. and 2.8 were not found. Either they were not enrolled in school or they were not enrolled in a program that was monitored by the National Student Clearinghouse, which covers about 98% of all of the post-secondary institutions in the U.S. A nearly equal amount of APS-eligible graduates, 930 students, attended an out-of-state post-secondary institution. Of these students, 3.6% of the total APS-eligible population had returned back to the state and were now attending an in-state university. 3.2 of them were not found. They could be dropouts or attending a non-tracked institution. And there's a much smaller number of APS-eligible graduates did not pursue post-secondary education the fall immediately following high school. That's the 432 number. Of those, some percentages did show back later as either attending an in-state or an out-of-state institution. But before we move on, note this pattern of attendance. In all, there's over 80% of the students were attending post-secondary education somewhere, and there's less than 20% of them were not attending or were not found in the National Student Clearinghouse. Now, if we move to the next slide, we see how non-APS eligible public high school graduates from 2011 compared. 67% of them, this is 3,833 out of a total of 5,723 students, were found not to be attending the fall following their high school graduation. And for the remaining ineligible students who did attend, they were more likely to be attending in Alaska in the fall of 2011, but they were less likely to be attending in the fall of 2012 than were their APS eligible cohorts. Taking a different look at APS student persistence, the table in this next slide looks at the students initially receiving the APS in fall 2011 and tracks the percentages returning to school and receiving the scholarship in the next two semesters. When breaking out APS recipients by the region, the top of the chart there, we note that every region except one had over 90% of students who attended the fall 2011 and received the APS returned the following spring. Only the far north region, the region that had the second highest utilization of the scholarship by AY11 graduates last year, fell below a 90% returning rate. They're the 75% in the third column of numbers. By the fall of 2012, just one half of recipients from the fall of 2011 returned in the far north region. And only the southwest region had fewer previous recipients returning at 34.6%. At the other extreme was the interior region.
Representative Sadler?
That's right. When you say return, do you mean return to high school for the second year? The implication you received two scholarships? I'm not quite sure what you say.
Through the chair, if I can clarify.
Yeah.
These are the APS eligible students who received or who graduated in AY11,
okay.
And they first received the award in fall of 2011. So if they received it here, how many of them received it in the following spring, and then how many of these students then came in and also received it in the fall of 2012?
The terminology is a little confusing to me. They receive it and they apply it and utilize it is more fair understanding.
Right.
They qualify for it, they receive it, and they use it year by year during their post-secondary education.
Right.
And they don't actually receive it and reauthorize every year they attend college.
Right, they're receiving the payment in that term.
Okay, gotcha.
Ms. Burns?
Yes, just essentially this is to show persistence rates.
Gotcha. You just receive is the word.
Yes. Thank you.
Again, it's at the other extreme of our usage here was the interior region. They had the highest usage rate of any region. In other words, usage meaning students were actually attending and receiving the scholarship. This is the top line for the interior region. They had 75% of those students who attended in the fall 2011 were continuing to receive the award in the fall of 2012. So high persistence in that area.
If I could just add as well on this, I should make the point that students may be enrolled but not receiving the scholarship. So, this is partially persistence, partially continuing eligibility.
because if they fail to meet the requirements to continue to receive the award their second fall, the second year that they're attending, then they would have to attend without the scholarship until they had met those requirements.
But enrolled and not receiving, they still the limit on semesters still counts against them or not?
No, Mr. Chair, the 8 semesters they have to use that aid in the 6 years after they graduate. So, any period of time that they are enrolled but not receiving it would not reduce their remaining semesters of aid.
Thank you, Mr. Sadler.
And a question. Thank you. I think where you're going to is what are the eligibility requirements to continue receiving it once you're enrolled in college?
And we will address those in just a second.
Thank you.
There was also some differences we saw in the continued use of the scholarship, the continued receipt of the scholarship, I would say, based on ethnicity. But the student's award level seems to be the best predictor of continued APS usage. For those, and that is here, for those students receiving the APS in the fall of 2011, the higher the award level, the more likely the student would continue to use it both in the spring and then in the following fall. And this pattern carried through in the subsequent fall when over 80% of the award level 1 recipients in the fall of 2011 were found to be enrolled and receiving the award the following fall. For the levels 2 and 3, you'll see it's right at 60% for those populations. And the students in the class of AY11 were also the only ones so far who were required to meet the scholarship's continuing eligibility requirements. The first certification of a student's continuing eligibility occurs after the student has received either 2 semesters or 3 terms of APS awards. And for full-time students, the vast majority of the APS recipients, as we've seen, they must have earned at least 24 semester credit hours and maintained a GPA of 2.0 or higher. Those students who fail to do so must continue their program of study without APS funding until the applicable criteria are met. As shown in this slide, the interior region, which remember had the highest percentage of students continuing to use the scholarship in the fall of 2012, also had the highest percentages of students meeting the continuing eligibility requirements at 90%. And now, well, we'll have to go without. The Southwest region had nearly 30% of those recipients not meeting continuing eligibility requirements, but that was also the region with the lowest percentage of students continuing to receive the scholarship, if you remember. Similarly, students' award levels and continuing eligibility fit the pattern that we had seen earlier. The top award level recipients were the students most likely to continue to use the scholarship and were also the ones most likely to meet the continuing eligibility requirements. So 93% of level 1s continued to meet eligibility, 78-79% of levels 2 and 3.
Yes, Mr. Sadler.
Thank you. And if someone's if a student fails to meet that continuing education, continuing eligibility criteria, does the 8 semester clock still run while they're on?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, the 8 semester clock doesn't run, but the 6-year clock does.
Okay. Moving to our next slide, and again using University of Alaska data. We can evaluate the persistence of students who attended and received the APS in fall 2011 and were again enrolled in fall 2012. UA data, just for their entire student population, shows that 73.8% of all what are called first-time, full-time freshmen enrolling in fall 2011 returned to UA in fall 2012. APS recipients from the class of AY11 have proven more likely to return the following year, with nearly 83% enrolling in the fall 2012. This is the first report when we have included data on the employment and earnings of APS eligible students. As illustrated on this slide, at this time the information again doesn't show how the APS has affected students' future earnings. We're still several years away from being able to do that. We believe that will occur, after we have completion data, so it's more than 4 years down the pipeline for us to be able to report on the actual wage differentials APS recipients may experience as compared to their non-APS eligible students. However, the Department of Labor and Workforce Development did research the wages of those AY11 APS-eligible graduates and provided certain baseline data. Interestingly, some patterns did emerge in student earnings even back into their junior and senior years in high school. For example, the wage data shows that those students who eventually became eligible for the highest APS awards were less likely to have worked at any time during their junior and senior years in high school, and they continued that pattern into their first year of college. On the slide, you'll see that we have the three different APS eligibility levels, and these are for the percentage of students who were APS eligible at that level who had shown wages at any time, at any quarter.
I'm sorry, it's a little hard to read those three bars.
It is. The bottom bar is the APS level one.
Okay.
The bar in AY10, the bar directly above that is the APS level two, and then the bar with the slightly darker shading around this perimeter is APS level three.
Thank you.
Certainly. And again, these are the students, the percentage of students in those different levels who had worked at any time, had wages reported to the Department of Labor during their junior, senior year in high school, and then their first year attending post-secondary.
Thank you. Representative Duke.
And that would actually include summer kids that are working during the summer, too?
Through the chair, in this particular slide, that includes anyone who had wages in any quarter of the year. Yes.
Thank you.
That's a good question, because this next slide shows that when we considered how much APS recipients were awarded, we saw similar patterns emerging as well. The Department of Labor and Workforce Development created what were four nearly equally sized groups of the APS recipients based on the amounts that they had received in their first year after graduation. Less than $2,000, $2,000 to $3,000, $3,000 to $4,000, and then greater than $4,000 in APS awards. This graph shows that those students who received the lowest award amount were more likely to have worked at some point during the year, and that extended back into their junior year of high school, actually. However, as we noted, working at any time during the year doesn't mean that a student has anything except a minimal attachment to the workforce. Many students take summer jobs in one of the state's seasonal industries, but they don't necessarily work during school. To identify those who did, the department identified students who worked in all four quarters of the year, as shown in this next slide.
So I'm not sure exactly what this all shows us and what it means to us. My college years, everyone worked at some point. And I'm not sure what, so those who had the most assistance didn't work at all. Those who had the least assistance did work. That makes sense. But what are the conclusions you draw, the patterns that you see here?
Well, actually getting the wage data from the department, we were not expecting to report much on it, just to show that we could, you know, we can track these students, see what their wage patterns are. Where we're really interested in is the future.
Right.
But we also should remember, too, as we think about recipients, these students were recipients in AY12. In their junior and senior years of high school, they did not know that they were going to be APS recipients. And we're still seeing some patterns emerging that those students who had the highest APS eligibility eventually became eligible for the highest award level had seemingly different patterns of work and their attachment to the workforce during their junior and senior years in high school. It may be another research topic to delve into.
Well, very interesting, and I understand that through time we'll have more information and more understanding. It just seems that the working in the job market is good for everybody. Senator Gardner.
Yeah, I find it incredibly interesting that the two extremes start out together and then diverge, and the middle two are fairly parallel, which isn't such a surprise, but...
Yeah, I would just add through the chair, Senator Gardner, that one of the things that we want to be aware of is the characteristics of the students who are, when they impact their ability to succeed in post-secondary education. One of the things I think we want to be able to do is if somebody looks at the statistics and they say, well, you know, it looks like our level three and level two students are just not succeeding as well as our level one students, is that just because of the academic preparation? And I think we want to be able to say, well, there's other data that we have that suggests there are factors outside of that that may be impacting their ability to focus solely
on their academics at the post-secondary level. So this is just all information, I think, that's to inform that discussion over time.
Thank you, Senator Gardner.
Thank you. I have a question that's a little bit off this slide. Actually, nothing to do with this slide. And that is, the data that we're looking at is from the University of Alaska, and I know that there aren't very many of our APS students who are going to private institutions. But there's been a little bit of a scandal nationwide about some of the private technical trade schools that students either don't graduate or graduate with huge debt. And I'd be sort of interested when our numbers are adequate to do anything to sort of understand how they're doing in the private schools as well.
Through the chair, again, looking at appendix, I believe it's C, you'll see the schools okay. that are eligible to receive it. And I wouldn't necessarily label any of those as schools that were fitting your description.
Oh, okay. Well, I'd just be interested to see the data at some point to know that the students that are going to non-UA schools, do they have similar patterns of accomplishment, of achievement, of attendance, whatever?
Thank you, Senator. Mr. Ray, we have about 9 minutes left. It looks to me like we're about right on track with your slides. Is there more material that you have beyond the slides, or are we doing fine?
There's not.
Okay. Please continue.
And as we're going back to the discussion about what is this showing us, the first couple of slides were showing us that students at their different award levels and the eventual recipients of the awards showed slightly different employment patterns, their attachment to the workforce. As we look at this slide, however, and remember that when we're looking at the level of the students at this level of attachment to the labor force, they worked in all four quarters compared to what we looked at earlier, which was only one quarter of wage earnings. The numbers have shrunk considerably. It was between 45 and 60% of students that I'd shown you earlier worked at least one quarter. Now we're looking at only 22 to 30% of the students who worked in their junior year in high school in all four quarters, a much smaller population. But after they graduated in AY11, those students receiving the lowest award amounts were much more likely than their peers to have worked in all four quarters. So this is where they're in their post-secondary education years, and it's those students who are receiving the lowest amount of awards are showing that they're working in all four quarters, much more likely to have worked in all four quarters. If we carry this on and use another indicator of attachment to the workforce, is earnings. Similar to the difference between having ever worked and having worked all four quarters as an indicator of workforce attachment, the amount of wages these students earned can serve as an indicator of how many hours the students are working. Now, there's certainly differences in wages for students, but for the most part, these are entry-level jobs these students are filling, and they're likely paying similar wages. So if this holds true, then increased earnings indicate higher numbers of hours worked in general. For those students working in all four quarters in high school, we see that the earnings are very similar. It doesn't matter, you know, they're not receiving any APS funding back in the AY10, AY11. However, once they enter college, those students receiving the highest award amounts are the ones with the lowest wage income. Presumably, they're working the least amount of hours while they're also attending school and receiving the scholarship. Again, this wage and workforce attachment data does not relate to the receipt of an APS award affecting their future earnings. It may, however, provide an indicator that supports some students' assertions in the survey that receipt of the scholarship allowed them to focus more of their attention on their education and less on having to pay for it. So with that, I will close. I'll just thank you again for your time. If you do have questions, here's my contact information. Please feel free to get back in touch with me.
Thank you. On that last slide, would you say that the students working earning $15,000 at the end there are working 40-hour work weeks or 40-hour work week, or any connection between hours worked and dollars earned?
I think the only assumption we could make there, and I used to work for the Department of Labor for several years, we do not have wage data and hourly data for these individuals. Sure. We know how much they earned over the course of a year. Because of that, we could maybe assume that they were working, again, relatively entry-level jobs, And if you wanted to make, and I would defer this to the Department of Labor, but if you wanted to make an assumption of what their hourly wage might be, you could possibly back into a how many hours did they work type of calculation. But that's sure. out of my league.
Understand. Thank you. Further questions? Well, that was fascinating. I'm really pleased to have that report. It's good to hear where we are this early in the game. We look forward to every year adding more information and more knowledge about how the scholarships are working.
Thank you. Appreciate the chance to do that. I know that the similar initiatives have happened in other states. And any correspondence between you and other states to see what kind of work they're doing along the similar lines? See if it correlates with what you're finding.
As the researcher, I have had conversations with Wyoming, with the Hawthorne scholarships that exist there, and just comparing some of the information that they have been able to glean. We have possibilities of having a richer data set than Wyoming does because our Department of Labor captures the occupational data for workers in the state, so we may be able to see if students who pursue a certain program of study then end up being employed in an occupation that relates to that program of study. But we converse, we meet at conferences, and we talk research talk.
I'm sure. I mean, the CD is all state by state by state. And I know that your job as a researcher is to present data to us, and the conclusions are ours to draw, but I'll throw you a softball anyway. Any conclusions that reach out and strike you as notable that you'd want to make based on the data you presented today?
Through the chair, I think the one thing that struck me, and much of this comes through the anecdotal information we received from the survey respondents, was that there was a difference in the student population between AY11 and AY12 in their ability to consider the scholarship, that they had enough time to think about attending school, and possibly, I'm going to jump to a conclusion, but possibly that's why we see those students who were at the lower award levels were saying, well, if I have an opportunity to be financed for my post-secondary education, I may pursue it. I wouldn't have otherwise considered it. Students in the survey were telling us specifically that I would never have considered or couldn't have gone to school had it not been for the performance scholarship. So again, that increased awareness probably had an effect in the differences that we're seeing between AY11 and AY12. We'll see AY13. We throw several things in the mix, including increasing rigor for the curricula. So it's hard to sometimes surgically separate the different effects that each has. But
Ms. Barron, as you mentioned, future, I think you said the future years that things are under discussion. Are there legislative issues that need to be discussed in the future, or are you talking about all administrative issues that you're considering?
No, Mr. Chair, one of the things that we're working on as a separate project with the Department of Education, Department of Labor, and the University of Alaska is developing a statewide longitudinal data system. In order for us to have as rich a repository as possible, it would be beneficial to have more detailed student-level information so that you could know, you know, has there been a shift in students' course-taking patterns? What for students who have shifted their course-taking patterns but might not have qualified for the scholarship, are they pursuing post-secondary education and having success at higher levels? I think one of the things is that the impact of the APS program, our hopes are, is that it will go beyond just the impact of the financial aid and have effects on the aspiration and preparation of the entire student population. So we are working on a project. We're probably about 3 years out from actually being able to tap that, but right now we're at that discussion about how do we, in an appropriate, secure manner, how do we collect that data and make it available both to the practitioners and the districts in the form of feedback to them, but to the public generally.
Thank you. That's very good to hear. Thank you for those comments. I believe we had some questions for the commissioner. We'll catch them later, and appreciate Ms. Barron's, Mr. Ray, your spending time with us. Very valuable to do this, and look forward to further reports. Thank you, and we're adjourned.